This is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. So Rebecca Solnit showed how knowing what public action has done and can do, and doing that, is a key to managing woe. But there's more you can do. You can turn your eyes around in your head and begin separating the emotional wheat from the chaff. But how?
Buddhists would advise you to let it rain. R. Recognize your emotions as they churn through your body. A. Accept them and don't try to change them. I. Investigate them, but don't psychoanalyze. Stay close to the raw experience. And finally, N. Non-identify. Detach. These emotions may fly through you, but they are not you. Recognize, accept, investigate, non-identify, rain. But how do you get there from here? How do we short-circuit the wiring that leads to embracing bad information that supports our views and the reflexive dismissal of the character and motives of those not within our own tribe? Bob Wright, author of Why Buddhism is True, The Science and Philosophy of Meditation and Enlightenment, says that before we can get our minds moving in a healthier direction, we first have to know where they've been.
Brains were designed by natural selection to do one thing, get genes into the next generation in a particular environment, in something more like a hunter-gatherer environment. And that's why you see crazy things like road rage that don't seem to make any sense. I mean, rage made a little more sense in a different environment.
Explain.
Well, in a hunter-gatherer environment, rage gets you to demonstrate that you cannot be taken advantage of. Somebody tries to steal a possession, a mate, whatever. You show you're willing to fight. You get mad enough to fight. Even if you lose the fight, you've demonstrated that there's a cost, okay? Well, you take this out on the highway. Well, first of all, nobody who's watching are you ever going to see again. There's no point in demonstrating anything to them. Plus, now you're going 80 miles an hour, and the consequences could be worse. And, you know, same with a lot of things. Anxiety, guilt, a lot of things kind of misfire in the modern environment.
Give me an example of how guilt misfires.
You might feel you did something to somebody. You wonder, did I offend them? And you feel a little guilty. But they're not, like, living right next door to you. You won't see them around the campfire that night. And that kind of thing can fester for a long time and just go unresolved. It's not quite worth emailing them about, and you're left there wondering. That just didn't happen in the natural environment. Everyone you interacted with pretty much all the time.
So what you've got is an accumulation of, like, a haystack full of little twigs that you carry around like a weight that are meaningless and that don't matter.
Yeah, well, one of the take-homes of Buddhism is that you should not assume that your feelings have the meaning they seem to have. You know, when they tell you this person is a bad person or you should be upset about this, don't assume that they're giving you good guidance. And mindfulness meditation is, to a large extent, a way of looking at your feelings from a more objective standpoint. It doesn't mean you don't have feelings. You experience them, but you exert more conscious control over which feelings you let carry you away and carry your train of thought away.
You are not the first person I would assume would take a plunge into Buddhism. You seem to be far more engaged in examining faith than in embracing it.
It's true that I'm not a natural meditator. It doesn't come easily to me. I don't have a good attention span.
Me either.
So
do you have ADD?
Yeah.
Me too.
Yeah. I mean, to get into meditation at all, I had to go to a silent meditation retreat. Not everyone does, but that's what it took for somebody like me. But as for the fact that I'm analytical, as you said, I mean, mindfulness meditation is more analytical than people appreciate in the sense that it's a way of learning to kind of step back and analyze the feelings and thoughts inside your head, at least a way of viewing them with a kind of a calm objectivity.
I have an idea for spellbinding radio right now.
I'm ready.
Show me how to meditate.
Show you how to meditate. First of all, I don't have a license. No one should do anything I say from here on in. But what they typically say is, you know, close your eyes, assume a relaxed posture, pay attention to your breath, maybe pick a point like where it's entering your nose and exiting your nose. Some people pay attention to the rising and falling of the abdomen, but pick something to pay attention to. And then you know, just watch it. And your mind is going to wander. Don't get mad at yourself or beat yourself up. When you notice that your mind is wandering, that's a small kind of victory. So if anything, congratulate yourself. And then you'll get back to the breath.
Okay, your brain is calm. You've done the breathing for 2 hours or something. And once you've gotten good at that, no matter how many days it takes you, then you start concentrating on the sound of a bird outside the window, or what?
You could. I would say what's most relevant to this question of tribalism is focusing on your feelings and look at how you're reacting to things.
What feeling?
I remember I was at a retreat once and there was this guy who started snoring. He was falling asleep. And this really annoyed me. I'm like, I'm trying to meditate. And then I remembered, oh, wait, you're supposed to just be aware of your reaction. And the thing about a meditation retreat is you can get so, I guess you might say, good at this, at least temporarily, several days into a retreat, that once you see a feeling, like my kind of wrath for the person, I literally see it and I focus on it in a way that just dissolves it in the moment.
Now, you mean like as a big gray ball?
Well, you see where in your body, feelings reside somewhere in your body. If you are feeling sad and you sit down and just examine the sadness, which is a good shortcut, by the way, skip the breath, just wait until you have a feeling like sadness and sit down, close your eyes and say, well, what does sadness feel like? And you'll probably notice it tends to be some of it is up around your eyes and maybe elsewhere. But just the very act of observation, you're no longer thinking the sad thoughts that the sadness would make you think. Instead, you're just looking at the sadness. And that in itself is a measure of liberation.
You had mentioned that mindfulness helps you combat our natural tribalism because that's an emotional thing and you can identify it and then you can manage it better. And a big part of that is confirmation bias, which is our tendency to accept and retain information that supports our views and reject or ignore information that doesn't. Because in the final analysis, confirmation bias has nothing to do with thinking and everything to do with feeling.
Right. You know, confirmation bias is what drives fake news on both sides. You know, I think we've all done this thing of either sharing something on Facebook or retweeting something that turned out to be misleading or untrue. And we shared it without actually examining it. And if you ask yourself, why did you share it or retweet it? The answer is because it felt good. For example, recently, Trump went to Japan, and this story spread that he had shown that he didn't even understand that Japanese automakers make cars in the U.S. It turned out if you looked at his remarks in their entirety, that wasn't true. He clearly did understand that. But that spread—
But CNN reported—
To the point of CNN doing a little piece about how he didn't even understand this, and that was just not true. But if you ask, how did the story get magnified in the first place, you see the tweet, and it feels good to share it because you have this idea that Trump is stupid, and it feels good to confirm that view. And that's the kind of feeling that you will become more aware of if you do mindfulness meditation.
There's another kind of bias that you talk about in the book that maybe holds treatment for our poisonous politics.
Yeah, there's a really fascinating cognitive bias that I think has not gotten enough attention. And it's a form of what's called attribution error. In everyday life, you might be standing at a checkout counter, the person in front of you is rude to the clerk, and you think, that's a rude person. So you're attributing the rudeness to the kind of person they are. When, you know, for all you know, they have just found out that their spouse has cancer or something. You just don't know why they're behaving that way. And it turns out that how we do the attribution depends on whether somebody is in our tribe or outside of our tribe. So if it's somebody in our tribe and they do something good, we say, well, yeah, that's the kind of person they are. They're a good person. If they do something bad, then we explain it away and attribute it to circumstance. You know, they were under peer group pressure or whatever. Whereas people in the enemy tribe, if they do something bad, you say, yeah, Trump supporters do bad things. Naturally, they did this thing. If they do something good, you explain it away as being due to circumstance. And I think this kind of thing, it gets us into wars, and it does help sustain the tribal conflict.
Even more so, once you've got this explanation, you have no need to seek another.
Right.
So basically, this kind of attribution bias is a really big impediment to breaching the walls between tribes and increasing our understanding.
It impedes understanding. There are two kinds of empathy. People would imagine that the whole point of mindfulness meditation is to give you empathy in the traditional feel their pain sense. You know, in other words, emotional empathy. I feel sorry for the people on the other side. There's also something called cognitive empathy, which is just understanding what it's like to be them and why they do the things they do. And mindfulness meditation can help you, regardless of whether you even care about them, regardless of whether you feel their pain, it can help you get a clearer view of why they did the things they did. And in the case of Trump, it can help you understand that, well, it's not as simple as them all being racist or all being stupid or all being anything else. Different Trump voters were responding to different things. Some of them are actual issues that need addressing. But in any event, it seems to be the first step toward not getting Trump elected again is to understand clearly how he got elected. And I think it's important to understand that our minds naturally impede this kind of understanding, and we should be suspicious of them.
Okay, but I want you to make a better case to all the people who say to me when I say, we need to listen to the other side, they say, why should we mindfully meditate when they aren't going to? You know, what's in it for us?
If we spread less misleading information about the opposition and say less gratuitously unflattering things about them, which isn't to say you don't criticize Trump when he does something horrible. It's that you try to distinguish between the genuinely horrible things he's done, and there's enough of those to keep you occupied, and the kind of form of outrage that, you know, including just things like, look, I was as amused as anyone by Melania wearing high heels to a hurricane. But is it really worth spreading that as like a whole liberal meme that we're making fun of the first lady? Because I do think that there are these feedback effects, and a calmer, more deliberate approach is the beginning of calming things down. Because a big part of Trump's support derives from the idea that his followers are hated and held in contempt by coastal elites.
I also think getting exercised over the trivial invites fatigue and makes you less likely to sustain effective political action.
Right. Part of this is like a mental health issue. I mean, I just know a lot of people who spend a lot of time on Facebook or Twitter, and they wind up feeling horrible because they are so outraged. And I'm not advocating that you use meditation as some kind of insulation from what's going on. You could use meditation as a sedative. That's not what I'm recommending. I'm recommending using it to clarify your vision. The term I use is mindful resistance. I'm putting out a weekly newsletter now called the Mindful Resistance Newsletter. And it's an attempt to help people focus on things that are really important and process every day's news in a way that is conducive to their own mental health and conducive to their own effective action.
Bob, thank you very much.
Well, thank you, Brooke.
Bob Wright is the author of Why Buddhism is True, The Science and Philosophy of Meditation and Enlightenment.
Coming up, anxious, hopeless. Uh-huh. So what else is new?
This is On the Media.
On Notes from America, we have conversations with people across the country about how we can truly become the nation that we claim to be. Each week, we talk about race, our politics, education, relationships, usually all of them, because everything's connected. And you, our listeners, are at the center of those conversations. I'm Kai Wright. Join me on Notes from America, wherever you get your podcasts.